Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Utah sees a record jump in coronavirus cases, nearly 4,000 new infections on Thursday, and record high hospitalizations as well. We'll talk about that and the new emergency order from the governor. Plus, Republican Burgess Owens maintains his lead over incumbent Democratic Congressman Ben McAdams in Utah's hotly contested 4th Congressional District. And with the arrival of cold weather, homeless service providers hit snags as they try to finalize plans for overflow shelter space this winter. Those stories and more coming up on the show today. On the phone for all of this, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Sean P. Means. And Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Also, reporter Taylor Stevens joins us, and welcome to you, Taylor.
Good morning.
And news columnist Robert Gerke. Hi, Robert, and welcome to you.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
And listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments about all of the stories that we are covering today by tweeting to us. Our handle is at KCPW. You can also call 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Sean Means, we will start with coronavirus today. The numbers are pretty astounding, and of course, there are some pretty dire warnings that accompany the numbers. You know, people may be aware of the broad strokes, but lay this out for us in detail, if you would. Some record highs in various categories. Tell us just about those numbers, Sean.
Well, I mean, the big number yesterday, Thursday's case, is 3919, which broke the old record, the old record of a whole 6 days.
Yeah.
By nearly 1,000, nearly 4,000 new cases in one day was just unsettling everybody.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the other record that was broken yesterday is that as of yesterday we have 465 people in the hospital from COVID, and you know it was only a couple weeks ago where we were being warned that 400 was going to be 400 at one time was going to be straining the system. Well, we're still straining the system even beyond that.
And
also the fact that in the last 7 days 55 people in Utah died from COVID. So the numbers are continuing to ratchet up new records being broken all the time, and obviously records we don't want to have.
There were a couple that I noticed also in addition to those that you just mentioned. The rate of infection is pretty amazing, 23.2%. That's the 7-day average, which means that we're getting close to one out of every four tests conducted being a coronavirus infection. And then ICU utilization is really high as well. I can't remember the exact numbers, but there are two data points there. One is referral hospitals, which is the sort of big hospitals, and the other is just hospitals in general. And for referral hospitals, it was something like 87% of ICU beds were filled.
Right. And 87% filled in ICUs, that all the hospital folks will tell you, is practically filled. It's that big. It's sort of like if you have a restaurant that is, you know, has a capacity of 100 people and you have 87 people in there, somebody's order is going to get screwed up. You know, that's going to be a busy night. It's a similar thing with ICUs in that, 87% capacity is pretty much your full, and everybody's being stretched to the limit.
I just opened up the coronavirus the dashboard, the state's dashboard, and it says that when ICUs reach 85% capacity, the state is out of staffed ICU beds, indicating an overwhelmed hospital system. Sean, I know you were on the weekly briefing from state health and government leaders yesterday. This record-smashing day came 4 days after an emergency order from the governor. What, you know, just yesterday, what did the governor have to say? What was the message that he was conveying about these bad numbers?
Well, I mean, we all remember Sunday night, you know, our phones all going off at once at 9 in the evening saying, get on the TV at 9:30 for an emergency order. And then we heard Herbert's order. That was on Sunday. On Thursday, basically the message was, wait for the data to see how much the order is going to help. Because it's a 2-week order, The incubation period for the virus is 2 weeks. The hope is that by slamming the brakes on activities for 2 weeks will help bring the virus down. But we're not going to see those numbers for at least another 10 days.
Let's talk about the emergency order then. I mean, that happened, as you said, on you know, we got the message on Sunday. The governor appeared on TV stations around the state, and then the order went into effect on Monday. What does it entail? What does it mean for residents of Utah? What are we supposed to be doing, Sean?
We are supposed to be everybody wearing a mask when we go outside, anywhere near people. Within 6 feet, if you're out in public and within 6 feet of other people, you're supposed to wear a mask. That is the rule. It's supposed to be statewide. That is the major. And supposedly that should not be a big deal for Utahns because 90% of the population was already under some sort of mask mandate because of the high, moderate, low designations for transmission rates in the counties. There are exemptions, and a lot of people have complained about that. There seem to be more exemptions than rules on this. That places of worship are exempt from the mask mandate. The enforcement issue is that it's going to be enforced at the local level. So county sheriffs and county health departments are supposed to be the ones enforcing the mask mandate.
Yeah.
And we've had instances for Iron County, for example, the sheriff there said he's not going to enforce any of the statewide mandates because, according to him, Iron County doesn't have a problem. That was one of the things the governor actually said in Thursday's briefing, which is Iron County's hospital may be okay at the moment, but because it's part of a system with other hospitals around the state, one bad case in Iron County is going to go begging because they're not room to transfer that person to St. George or to the Salt Lake Hospital.
You mentioned the mask mandate and that enforcement element. There's also a pause on after school activities with some exceptions. And then none of us are supposed to be interacting, at least socially, with anyone who isn't from our own household. How does that part of this work and how does it get enforced?
Well, that's the $64 question. Enforcement, again, local level, and there's no consistency and no seeming urgency from the governor. He talked again about at the last briefing about how he's counting on personal responsibility and for everyone stepping up and doing their part. He talked about local law enforcement and local health departments again enforcing this. And as you say, social gatherings, the idea is don't go out, basically. That's what Dr. Dunn's message was on Monday after the order came out, which is if you can, stay home. Obviously, there's a lot of people who cannot, and you have essential workers, you have schools that are still open in some places, although with the rise in cases, we've seen many schools have had to shut down in-person learning and go to online. There were like 25 schools yesterday, according to Tanner, got the list of many of them in the Jordan School District all suddenly switched over to online learning for 2 weeks because of the quarantine rules that were already in place. And after school activities, if it's a school-related activity, I mean school-sponsored activity, those are all shut down for 2 weeks except for football. The football playoffs were continuing this weekend and next weekend. Those are continuing under guidelines about if you are going to limited number of fans allowed to go, must wear masks, all that sort of thing.
And testing of the student athletes, I guess as well.
And testing of the student athletes, and then at the college levels, for example, tomorrow Utah State is playing Fresno State up in Logan. Utah State announced no fans. No, it's going to be an empty stadium with just the game going.
This might be a good point to bring in the columnist Robert Gerke. And Gerke, the idea here is, with the emergency order from the governor, is as much as anything an effort to send a signal to people, to residents. But then Sean didn't bring this up, but you can still go to the bar, you can go to restaurants and businesses, but you know, you're not supposed to be hanging out with people who aren't from your own household, I guess, just socially. Is there, what's your take on the emergency order? I mean, obviously, it's probably something that, well, I'll let you answer. Just go ahead, Kirky. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's needed. I don't know if it's adequate, but we needed to do something. We should have, as we've said, been saying on the show, or as I've been saying on the show every time I've been on it for the last 6 weeks, you know, it's he's waited too long. And so now we're already headed over a cliff right now. As Sean mentioned, I think the most frightening thing about this is that we are at capacity in these hospitals. Our cases are continuing to spike. And as Dr. Dunn noted yesterday, we anticipate 2 weeks before these take effect. Well, that's another 9 days of these kinds of rises in cases.
Right.
You know, there's no indication it's going to turn it, that we've turned a corner or reached a plateau. And so, you know, we're kind of there's not much we can do to bend this curve over the next 10 days. And we just got to ride it out and hope that these enforcement measures that the governor issued are going to work. There are some holes in them. You know, I don't think that, you know, I'm encouraged. One of the most encouraging things is seeing these high schools go online because, as we've talked about before, high school and college students seem to be the population where this initially started spreading, and they had a sort of a second spike since the first one back in September.
Yep.
You know, we've got to do something to get these cases under control because, you know, the cases precede the hospitalizations, which precede the deaths. And right now the death estimates are not encouraging.
No.
You know, the CDC estimate, which has been low, frankly, for the last couple of weeks, says 256 Utahns over the next 4 weeks. IHME from University of Washington, which is another model that a lot of people look at, is talking about 600 dead before the end of the year, 600 additional dead on top of what we've already seen. And, you know, on the trajectory we're on, it could very well be more than that. So this is frightening. People need to take it seriously. And it's frustrating to see, the governor's sort of long period of inaction, but B, the pushback he's getting from legislators, from anti-mask crowds, from, you know, the protests that have been going on, including at his home. You know, if these people thought this was a sham, they should have their eyes opened, I think, and based on what we've seen in the last several weeks.
Well, I mean, we talked about the governor with his order sending a signal. Another signal, obviously, is, and one that certainly carries more weight, is people being confronted, you know, with more friends who have tested positive or family members hospitalized and with the deaths that you're talking about. You know, I don't know. There's, what about the fact that, you know, we're 4 days into this emergency order, Gerke, and that means that we are 10 days out, maybe 9 days out if you discount today from this quote unquote circuit breaker period being over. Will we be able to know much by the end of that? I mean, whether the strategy is working, and then are we also going to see restrictions loosened just in time for Thanksgiving and people gathering? And is that dangerous, Gerke?
I mean, I certainly hope we don't see the restrictions loosened in that period of time. 2 weeks is nowhere near long enough to get, I mean, that's just long enough to maybe tap the brakes. We're going at a million miles an hour, and tapping the brakes isn't going to work. If you take your foot off the brakes, you're just going to start seeing that spike again. So 2 weeks is sort of a warm-up period, if you will, to, you know, to see if the restrictions that are being put in place are going to work. And if they do work, we've got to kind of keep those in place as we all hope, I think, we turn the corner and start coming down. We've got a long way down now, too, right? Even if hypothetically that we do peak in 2 weeks and we start seeing that curve starting to bend down, we're then at the top of the mountain and we have a long journey back down to where, you know, where we want to be and where we can start doing, you know, start easing these restrictions. So I'm certainly hopeful that the governor doesn't think 2 weeks and we're done, you know, dust off your hands and walk away. It's going to be a long slog probably through the end of the year. And, you know, the hopeful note that the governor sounded yesterday was that, you know, he's anticipating a vaccine coming along. And we had that big announcement from Pfizer, obviously.
Yeah.
It's encouraging. And, you know, they're talking about deployment of a vaccine or you know, for healthcare workers and for vulnerable populations, possibly by the end of the year or early next year, and then spreading it into the broader public by spring and summer. So that's the encouraging part of this. Obviously, that's a ways down the road, but we maybe can see a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel on this.
In the meantime, you know, before the vaccine, Sean Means, the governor yesterday and actually frequently talks about the economy, that, you know, businesses who want to make any money, you know, they'll do everything to make customers feel safe. And so basically, I guess the idea there is that the market will sort of enforce safety precautions. I mean, he sort of reiterated that yesterday, right, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, that's been the message all along, is that a company or a business like a store or a restaurant or whatever doesn't want to see their name in the headlines as the next, you know, COVID super spreader site. So they will do whatever they need to do to prevent that, and they'll set up you know, spaces between the tables at the restaurant or one-way aisles at the supermarket, what have you. And you know, again, this is the governor's belief that the market will solve the problems more than the government can.
Is there
your mileage may vary? Your mileage may vary, I suppose.
Your mileage may vary. Gierke, just before we head to a break, I'm wondering if there's a kind of mixed message to what that is, because I mean, on one half of the equation we have the order saying don't socialize with people from other households, but then on the market side that Sean's describing there, the governor's saying, you know, go ahead and go out to the bar or to wherever to spend your money, because those safety precautions are in place, so that, you know, money, I don't know. What do you say?
It's one of the most frustrating components of this, right? Because, you know, as Sean mentioned, we have the Iron County Sheriff, and I'm sure he's not the only one who says he's not going to enforce it. So basically our enforcement at that point ends up being put on, you know, waiters, waitresses, bartenders, clerks at grocery stores or convenience stores, who are supposed to be the ones to tell people that they have to wear masks. And if people don't want to wear masks, then what? That person now knows that there's not going to be any legal repercussions. I think, frankly, what we need to see is some people made an example of and have people arrested, have people charged with crimes for organizing events. I think the organizers, as we talked about before, that Halloween bash that we saw down in Lehigh, I think they should be charged with a crime. I think, you know, these people who are organizing these events need to be, you know, made an example of and be charged. And I think people who are not wearing masks, maybe then we'll start getting the point that, oh, they're taking this seriously. But right now, when you say, oh, we're going to enforce it, but, you know, nobody's really doing it. I did talk to folks at Salt Lake County, and they, you know, the health department has some authority to enforce events that would ordinarily need a permit if they're not permitted. The labor department supposedly has the ability to fine businesses that aren't enforcing mask requirements. But again, that puts these clerks and waiters and waitresses and bartenders in a position where they're the front line on this. And we really need a little bit more backup, I think, because they don't have the force of law. So it's going to be interesting to see. It's critical that people comply with it. And I think to get people that aren't complying now to comply with it, it's critical we have enforcement. One of the interesting data points we saw this week that we hadn't seen before was mass compliance by county. And, you know, if we're, you know, we live in Salt Lake County, we're probably a little, you know, in a, you know, unreal situation where we think everybody's wearing masks. But if you look at this data, it's down around 50% in a lot of counties, perhaps lower in others. So we've got to see people step up the compliance. We've got to see enforcement. And I think we should probably see some charges of people for organizing events that have the risk of becoming these super spreader events that we all want to avoid.
Okay.
And we've seen...
Sure, go ahead, Sean.
We've seen a lot of critics. Critics of what the governor's doing have said that, okay, the same state government, the same county governments that are saying they can't enforce a mask mandate are the same ones, you know, same county health departments who will shut down a restaurant if there's rat droppings, or, you know, the same state government that will shut down a bar if they're serving the wrong kind of beer. I think critics might have a point here that there's things the state and the counties can be doing that maybe they're not.
Sure. And it's an interesting conundrum that we find ourselves in where, again, politics kind of getting in the way of pandemic response. Speaking of politics, that's what we are going to turn to, the election, actually, after our first break in the show. And I'll just say, Sean P. Means, thanks for covering this for us. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Back with more from the past week in Utah news in just a moment.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Taylor Stevens and Sean P. Means, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can call us to join this conversation. The number is 801-355-8255 with your questions and comments, or you can tweet them to @KCPW. We will now turn to election news, or back to election news, I guess, because our election is dragging on. Let's turn to Taylor Stevens. Taylor, for a time, incumbent Democratic Representative Ben McAdams was leading in the 4th district race, but there was at some point a kind of switchover, and the challenger, Republican Burgess Owens, took the lead. Where are we in this race right now?
Yeah, Burgess Owens has held on to his lead for the past few days since he gained it on Saturday. And as of the latest vote totals that we had that dropped yesterday, his lead was sitting at about 1,600 votes over Ben McAdams. And this has been a really interesting race because, you know, early on we were seeing a lot of ballots dropped from Utah County earlier in the week. And, you know, once Utah County ballots kind of whittled down, I think they have about a few hundred left to count now. I think we anticipated that we would see Ben McAdams start to increase his lead or flip that around because he had a higher percentage of the vote in Salt Lake County. But over the past few days, he's seen his lead in Salt Lake County whittling down from averaging about 54% to about 51%, I think is where we were at yesterday. And that, you know, may sound small, but it's made a big difference in kind of keeping him from regaining the lead. And at this point, we have just a few thousand ballots left in Salt Lake County. They have, you know, 11,000 provisional ballots. Those are ones that were cast in person on Election Day. And those, you know, it's possible not all of those will be counted. There are also the cure ballots, so those ballots that had a problem with someone's signature. So we're getting down to the final votes that are being counted at this point, and that's kind of where we are.
I mean, 1,600, that's not a small number. And you said a few thousand. I mean, do we have an idea of exactly how many ballots are left in this race, or is that just an unknown factor right now?
It's hard to know just because, as I mentioned, some of those ballots that we have outstanding, it's not a sure thing that, like, all 11,000 of those provisional ballots will be counted, for example. Some of those might be discarded for any number of reasons, and same with the cure ballots with the signature issues. And so it's just kind of a moving target. There have also been, you know, as I've been talking to Salt Lake County Clerk Sherry Swenson throughout the week, she's mentioned, you know, they had some ballots that were still coming in the mail, even just a couple days ago. I'm curious to know where exactly those ballots are coming from. We don't have all that information, but, you know, whenever we talk about the number of ballots when you're voting by mail, it's a bit more of a moving target than it was when everyone voted in person on Election Day, and the number you had was the number you had. So we don't know exactly how many are left outstanding at this point.
It took until close to the actual election canvass date when the results are actually finalized, to know that McAdams had won back in 2018 against then incumbent Representative Mia Love. Is it going to take us until the canvass date to know the outcome of this race, which is actually, I guess, only 4 days away now, isn't it?
Yeah, so we're going to get ballots today. We're going to get some ballots on Monday. Excuse me. And, you know, it's not really clear. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if we did wait until the final canvass just because this race has been so close. But I think that, you know, it could change depending on what the picture is later today or what the picture is on Monday. But as you said, we're not that far away from the canvas when all of the votes are finalized. So we may be in for a couple more days of uncertainty in this race.
Robert Gerke, prognosticator of prognosticators, for a time you were predicting a turnaround for McAdams. Last week on the show even, I think you said that, were you wrong?
I was wrong, yeah. So what I was basing that on is if we looked at the precinct, I went down to the precinct level data and looked at where the votes had come in and where we would expect them to come in. And, you know, most of the precincts where they hadn't come in were McAdams precincts. So either A, they were going to come in, or B, they were not going to come in. I think those are the two options. It just made sense that they would, but they haven't. And for whatever reason, one hypothesis, I guess, is that in 2018, these people came out in big numbers for the medical marijuana referendum or the Medicaid expansion referendum, and then this year just stayed home. But I looked at, there are 30 precincts in the district that haven't gotten up to the turnout levels that we saw from those precincts in 2018, 30 of them, and 29 of them are McAdams districts. If you look at the districts that are below average this year, the overwhelming majority of the roughly 180 of them are McAdams districts. So for whatever reason, the votes didn't show up in those McAdams leading precincts, whereas they showed up in really high numbers in the South Valley, the Harriman, Bluffdale, Riverton area. And it's just put men in a position where the votes haven't come in. It's also, you know, we have to look at Shireen Gorbani's Salt Lake County Council race right now, because she was leading by about 3,000 votes. That's down to a whisker margin right now.
Right.
And in the state legislature, we saw Steve Ellison, who's been trailing for most since election night by close to 900, I think maybe more than 900 votes at one point. He's jumped back into a lead. So it's unusual, because typically we see Salt Lake County, you know, the trend is that it's a blue county, and you still would expect those votes to trend blue. But ever since election night, they've been red, and the blue votes just haven't shown up.
And that's interesting, given the sort of motivations of Democratic voters during this election. You would have maybe expected more of a turnout. I don't know.
I certainly did.
I
assume Ben McAdams probably did too.
You know, I'll point out that you also called the presidential race last week on this show before the Associated Press or anybody else had. So is this race done and dusted? I mean, do you think that this is?
No, I mean, I had a piece up today that you can check out at fltrib.com where I kind of break down the math. McAdams was in a very similar situation to where he was 2 years ago. 2 years ago, after Utah County came in, he was behind Mia Love by 1,500 votes, roughly. This year, he's behind by 1,600 votes. Last year, there were about 7,900 ballots out there. This year, there's about 7,500 is my best estimate, assuming, as Taylor mentioned, those ballots may not all get counted. A couple complicating factors. There's a third-party candidate this time that we didn't have last time that's going to siphon off some of the votes. And that tailwind that I mentioned about with the blue votes not coming out, you know, like 2 years ago, there was the referendums pushing the turnout. He got 64% of that last batch of votes. This year, he would need about 61-62% to get even. So, you know, it's not over. There's still some votes hanging out in Utah County as well. So I think Taylor's right. We're going to be watching this probably right up until the canvas on Tuesday to see where the votes come in. But McAdams is in a worse position than he was 2 years ago, I think, and Owens is in a much better position than Neil Love was 2 years ago.
I'd like to actually turn to Taylor for another story that is sort of connected to this race. I mean, it's connected to this race because of the person involved. And Taylor, that's that the candidate in the lead, Burgess Owens, is at least fundraising or in fundraising materials that he is sending out, making some claims about the election. I actually don't know how to set this up. What is it that he or his campaign is saying, Taylor?
Yeah, so the basic message is that they are trying to fundraise dollars based on what they allege is Democrats trying to steal the election away from Burgess Owens in the 4th Congressional District race. And those claims have only been made in fundraising emails they say, you know, don't let Burgess be robbed of a conservative victory here in Utah, and say that there are shady last-minute tactics from Democrats. I did call the campaign yesterday to ask, you know, what they were referring to. They said that they have had a few people reach out to them with claims of voting irregularities or voting fraud that the campaign is looking into, but it doesn't appear that they have brought any of those concerns to the state elections director, who said that he hasn't received any complaints of substance to them and that no specific campaigns have made allegations of fraud to him, to his knowledge, as of yesterday. You know, we have had this as kind of a national sort of rhetoric about fraud and irregularities on the part of the Trump campaign, making some of those claims. And so far, all 50 states have said that they haven't seen any evidence of that. The New York Times had a story this week where they reached out to election directors in all of the states, and they hadn't had any evidence of that. And several Utah politicians have also spoken against this idea. Utah Governor-elect Spencer Cox, lieutenant governor, whose office oversees the elections, said that there's no evidence of voter fraud. And you know, he was speaking generally, not specifically to this congressional district 4 race. But, you know, all signs point to this just isn't a verified claim. The Owens campaign, interestingly, did seem to say that they were trying to raise some money in case of a recount, which is very different from, you know, there being an effort to steal the election away from them. So,
And that's, like, I was going to ask you what the fundraising was actually for, and so maybe it's for legal challenges that play out after, you know, if this election is too close or if this particular race is too close to call. You mentioned, you know, local officials talking about how secure the vote was. There's PBS NewsHour has a conversation with people from the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security, saying that this was basically the most secure election that we've seen. I guess, you know, this might be a good point to turn. First, maybe I should get some comments from Robert Gierke. And Gierke, we don't have a lot of time, but I want to also turn to another story that Taylor covered, which has to do with the Attorney General of Utah. But first, just on this fundraising tactic of saying that there was voter fraud in Utah.
I mean, it's not too surprising because we've seen Burgess Owens run a Trump-style campaign throughout, and this is a Trump tactic. We saw the president do the same thing. And I think it's unfortunate because it does, you know, both tactics by both men undermine the legitimacy of the elections or have the potential to do that. But, you know, it's not too surprising, and, you know, we should expect it, I think, at this point.
Okay. All right. Well, so, yeah, I mean... again, through the years, we've seen these like nonpartisan reviews of elections and voter fraud in the United States is very rare. President Trump, though, as Taylor mentioned, if you look at his, you know, his Twitter feed, is claiming that there has been all kinds of voting malfeasance in this election. And Taylor, as we mentioned last week on the show, Utah's attorney general took some time off or took a personal weekend, I guess, to sort of help the president make the case that had been happening. Can you remind us what Attorney General Sean Reyes was doing? And then we can come to your sort of follow-up story that you wrote this week.
Yes. Last Friday, while we were on the show, actually, that he was taking personal leave time to help fight legal battles in states, basically for what he claimed was a compromised election process, that he's going to help the Trump campaign fight these legal battles in some of these swing states and states where they have made some parties have made claims of voter fraud or, again, irregularities. So he was on the ground in Nevada. He later clarified that he was not taking a leave of absence, but was instead taking a personal weekend to help review and advise on some of these potential lawsuits. The attorney general's office said that this was personal time for him, that no office funds were being used for the work, for travel, food, accommodation, et cetera. But Sean Reyes did come under fire for these statements. Especially on Monday, he made some claims that he had seen evidence of voting irregularities and may have resulted in improper votes being counted. And several organizations, several politicians from both parties have criticized him for, you know, undermining faith in democracy and faith in elections without evidence. He, as I mentioned on Monday, made those claims about voting irregularities. And then, interestingly, on Wednesday, the Attorney General in Nevada, Aaron Ford, he also came out criticizing Sean Reyes for saying he'd seen evidence of voting irregularities in the state. And Ford, who is a Democrat, he noted that there was no evidence of voter fraud. He said that Reyes hasn't returned his phone calls or texts to have a conversation about any of this. And he said that Reyes's claims were kind of a slap in the face and, you know, that he should mind his own business and kind of tend to his own state, I suppose.
Okay. And again, that as you said, the Utah Attorney General has received a fair amount of criticism. And a lot, you know, a lot of the criticism is basically the same criticism that is lobbed at the president, that the idea of saying that this is rigged is possibly going to undermine confidence in the U.S. electoral process. Has the Attorney General responded to the criticism that he's been getting? I mean, has he said anything beyond the fact that, you know, maybe he saw some irregularities? So, Taylor?
You know, I did reach out to the campaign, and I never heard back as far as the Nevada Attorney General's comments go. In his statement on Monday, he did seem to kind of address some of the criticism. He said, you know, people, they may not like post-election scrutiny, but it's a right that can't be ignored. This kind of inquiry is part of the process, and I am proud to assist in it. And, you know, to be clear, I don't think anyone is saying that it's not worth, you know, doing recounts when warranted by law or, you know, investigating potential claims, but making claims without evidence that there has been an attempt to rig an election or that, you know, there has been mass voter fraud without evidence is more the concern, I think, with his comments on the part of his opponents. Hmm.
And I think that's the case that a number of people who are making that argument are saying is that, look, this is going to help you have further confidence in the election because we're going to get to the bottom of, you know, we're going to get to the truth or whatever. But the idea that it's part of the process, this is a question that I want to ask Robert Gerke. I mean, the idea that courts getting involved in elections is just a normal part of the process, is that the case?
It's not abnormal, I guess. It's not unheard of, but I think we haven't seen it in my recollection at this scale, where you have a campaign challenging the results in four different states, tens of thousands of votes in most of them. I mean, in Nevada, for example, I mean, Joe Biden won that state by 36, almost 37,000 votes. It's not terribly close, and to challenge that many is a little bit unprecedented. And I think that, you know, if they want to challenge it, they can challenge it, but they haven't been able to come up with any concrete or, you know, specific allegations of wrongdoing or malfeasance. You know, they're challenging dozens of votes here or there, and that's not going to get them where they need to be. And you know, I think it's also worth noting that the Trump campaign, one of the things that they did in Nevada is they identified 3,000 people whose addresses were not in the state, and they said they voted illegally. Many of those people happened to be in the U.S. military. They were serving in Air Force bases or naval bases, and yes, they can vote when they're doing that. And you know, so I think trying to disenfranchise military members is not a smart play if that's what they're going for. So you know, obviously they're going to continue these tactics. I think we'll see how they play out, and I don't think I haven't seen any election experts who have said that there's much chance of this changing the outcome of the election. But again, as I wrote last week or earlier in the week, it's really doing damage to the people's trust in our election process. 7 out of 10 Republicans right now think the election wasn't fair. And, you know, that has taken a big jump since the president and people like Sean Reyes started making this noise.
Yeah, I saw the former president of Ireland, Mary Robinson, talking about the claims of voter fraud, sort of giving comfort to autocrats around the world, was her comments on this. And it's an interesting moment to be living through, and we'll have to leave it there and go to another break in the show. But thank you, Robert Gerke, for your commentary, Taylor Stevens, for your reporting on this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Sean P. Means, Taylor Stevens, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Weigh in on what you've been hearing by calling us, 801-355-8255. Again, also, you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Taylor Stevens, we are going to turn to homelessness. You wrote a couple of stories that touch on this this week, and we'll probably actually only have time for one of them. There is a need for winter overflow shelter for people experiencing homelessness here in northern Utah, and that's because there just isn't enough space in the sort of normal system that exists for homelessness here. Maybe you can actually start there. Explain that gap in space, where it comes from, and then we can turn to the attempts to find space to shelter people during the harsh winter here in this part of the state.
Yes, that gap in the number of available beds for people experiencing homelessness is actually baked into this new system that replaced the Road Homes old downtown shelter in the Rio Grande neighborhood. And that old emergency shelter had space for 1,100 people, and that's on beds as well as masks and cots, but you know, still enough space for that many people. When they changed this new system with three smaller resource centers placed kind of across the Salt Lake Valley, two in Salt Lake City, one in South Salt Lake, they only created enough space for 700 people. And we asked a lot of questions about this. We wrote a lot of stories about the potential this had for disaster because, you know, there was a 400-bed gap and the state is growing. And last winter, we saw that really come to fruition with, you know, too many people seeking access to too few beds. There is some overflow built into the system. They open St. Vincent de Paul Dining Hall each winter that has space for about 50 people, I think, but definitely not enough to fill the gap. And so, you know, last winter was really tough for the new system. Also, there were just some, you know, growing pains with working this new system out. And they eventually did have to open an emergency overflow shelter, which Salt Lake City Mayor Erin Mendenhall did, I think in her first week or one of her first weeks in office in January. And the promise to the Sugar House neighborhood that they put that in was that this was only going to be temporary and was only going to be for one season. But then what we find is, you know, going into this winter, there needs to be a different solution because they're aware of these bed deficits. Also, with COVID-19, that's stretching the system a little bit further, where the normal overflow options can't accommodate as many people because they need to be spaced out. You know, you don't want to run the risk of exposing people in a congregate setting to COVID. So they need to get even more creative this year than they did last year as far as finding space for people. And so that kind of brings us to
tell us
today.
Tell us where we are. What is happening this year? Because, again, as you said, there were, you know, Salt Lake City stepped up, offered up space for the overflow shelter last winter, cots, security, a site, the old Deseret Industries building in Sugar House. What's the plan now?
Yeah, so that is still being worked out. And it's November. We had a big snow over the weekend. You know, this isn't ideal for, you know, at least we're further along this year than we were last year when an emergency overflow shelter wasn't sited until January. But still, this is a pressing issue that needs to be addressed as far as shelter space goes. So the Salt Lake Valley Coalition on Homelessness has been working on this issue for a few months. They've been trying to identify space, and that's not, you know, an easy thing to do to find a community, and that's kind of evidenced by what we're seeing now, which is one of the two overflow sites the Salt Lake Valley Coalition on Homelessness has identified. The Midvale La Quinta Inn on 7200 South is now kind of coming under, you know, criticism from the community. Midvale does have a family shelter that houses, you know, families, children, parents of children. And Midvale Mayor Robert Hale says that he doesn't think that their community should have to house this overflow shelter. And he has a couple of concerns about it. But first, just kind of the logistics of it. So this would be a shelter or a kind of voucher system in a hotel. This is a willing hotel owner that's had its occupancy decline a lot with COVID. And so this hotel owner is seeing this as kind of a win-win, a place to give shelter to some people while also making some money up for the challenges of COVID. And I believe they would house about 140 people experiencing homelessness in this space. But the concern for the Midvale community is that this is an area that is already seeing some high crime. They don't want to add another 140 people into this area, both out of concern that that might bring additional crime, but also that they would be putting vulnerable people into an area where there is, you know, kind of a criminal element that could prey on them. But, you know, the other thing is they kind of feel like they've done their share, that they have a homeless shelter. And, you know, one of the council members in a meeting this week said, you know, Riverton should be doing its share. Draper should be doing its share. Some of these southern counties that have a lot more land and their hotels are probably just as empty. And so, you know, this community is just being passed from, you know, the homeless community being passed from community to community, with each community kind of saying, like, we don't feel we should have to do this, or someone else should have to do their part. And it makes it really tough for, you know, those trying to site this community in a particular location to really find a willing community at this point. You know, Sugar House community did take this, but again, with the caveat of, we don't want this to be permanent. And so there does need to be a permanent solution to this, because otherwise we're going to see this coming up year after year of just trying to pass from community to community, and that's just not a long-term solution.
So finding additional and permanent shelter space is basically the end game. But what happens this winter is anyone's guess. Taylor, I am sorry to cut you off, but I'm going to end it there. I mean, the question left hanging in your article is, you know, what's going to happen, and we don't know. The La Quinta Inn was offering to take them. Midvale doesn't want them. I guess we just wait and see, and you'll follow up. Okay. Taylor Stevens is a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, and I'm sorry that we're out of time here, and we will now turn to our final segment of the show, which we do every week, which is the underplayed stories of the week, and I will bring Sean P. Means back in to get us started. Sean, what's your pick for underplayed story of the week?
Well, I'd say overplayed story would be The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City, which premiered on Wednesday and seems churlish to mention after all the talk about homelessness. So I will instead talk about Kristen Press, probably one of the best soccer players in the world, one of the stars of the U.S. women's team. She had been a star for the last couple of years at the Utah Royals. She is leaving. She was picked up by Louisville in the expansion draft. She probably would have left Salt Lake anyway because she had signed a contract with Manchester United. But just say goodbye to, like I said, one of the best soccer players in the world who was gracing Utah for a short time.
All right. A change for an institution here in town, too, as well. That's Sean P. Means' pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. Robert Gerke, I'll go to you. What's your pick for Underplayed Story?
Yeah, just quickly, Tony Zimmerman has sort of dovetails with the discussion we're having about homelessness, a story about a former Ute basketball player, Ken Gardner, who is now facing eviction in like many Utahns. I think 2,300 was the number I saw in the story, evictions in the last couple months because of, you know, a lot of it related to COVID, health issues, and it just kind of looks at it as a microcosm of the issue that we're facing as these eviction moratoriums expire and more people are facing uncertain futures. So until we get the housing issue resolved, our housing scarcity issues resolved, the homelessness issue is going to be with us.
All right. You can check that out at sltrip.com, as well as Sean P. Mean's story. And Taylor Stevens, your pick for Underplayed Story.
You know, I also was going to highlight Tony Semerad's work from today. So I'll just give another plug to go and read that work about evictions and the challenges that are facing many Utahns.
Okay, great. And I, for my part, I will go with the sale of Fremont Island in the Great Salt Lake to a conservation buyer. Brian Maffley reports that it's Jennifer Spears who has purchased and preserved other lands in the state. Supposedly, the sellers were planning on putting houses out there, which sounds to me extremely far-fetched on a sort of desert island in the Great Salt Lake. And since it's just after Halloween, I will remind everyone that Fremont Island is where the early Salt Lake City grave robber Jean Baptiste was banished by Brigham Young. Seriously, that really happened. And last year on a KCPW show in the Hive, producer Tim Pierce and I spent some time digging up all of the details on that. And if you search Grave Robber and KCPW, you can find that podcast. Everything else, though, that we've been talking about, you can find at sltrib.com. And I will just say, Sean P. Means, Taylor Stevens, Robert Gerke, all from that newspaper. Thank you very much for joining me, from the Salt Lake Tribune, that is. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Stay safe.
You too. That does it for Behind the Headlines, a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or in whatever app you use to listen to podcasts. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend. Do stay safe and join us again next week.